This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 340 of the Outlander podcast. I am Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
Welcome to episode number 415 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode, we'd like to thank co-producer Elizabeth S.
Any announcements this week?
Nope.
I don't think so either. I think it's been, they were like, we're coming in June, and then they just let it go. And they're like, okay, it'll be cool. Maybe you'll see some more stuff later. In our An Echo in the Bone read along, we are continuing with chapter 18 entitled Pulling Teeth.
New Bern, Colony of North Carolina, April 1877. Claire has put out her shingle and is working as a surgeon of the day, which means she's also pulling teeth. And the teeth of this poor young girl, Snaggletooth, are apparently just awful. This girl's mom wants to charge Claire for pulling extra ones at least. Because Claire's like, yeah, that one needs to go, but you know what? I can help her out. I can help her dentition and her likelihood of, I don't know, a future or smile or whatever. And she's like, okay, how much you want for them? Excuse me, what? However, in order to get to the abscessed one, the one that is really causing all the problems, she needs to not have the girl basically be anesthetized. So Claire gives her some whiskey and has eat Youngie and help out with it. And the mom even helps out until she's knocked out. So she's using this small handheld mirror to direct sunlight into the surgical area, but she needs some help because people outside on the little, I don't know, what do you call it? The walkway outside the business, the sidewalk, whatever they were called, are walking back and forth as you have every right to do. So she
like a boardwalk. Don't they call it a boardwalk?
Oh, yeah, like a boardwalk kind of thing. So she enlists the help of Henri Christian. And when I first read it or was first rereading it, I thought, oh, that's right. She gets his help. It doesn't make sense when I say this even. She gets his help to hold the mirror. No, Ginger. He's not tall enough to like probably help out much. And then as I read it, I'm like, oh, that's right. He's called to like not make a diversion, but as entertainment. I mean, I know she loves him. This is not against Claire necessarily. I guess it's more about Diana, but how do you feel when you kind of are reading these like years and years past
the exploitation of handicapped people?
I guess.
People with a birth defect or,
something. It's not just exploitation. I mean, yeah, it's exploitation, but it's also exploitation. So exploitation is use, right? That's like, I mean, it's more than use. It's using someone for a purpose unfairly and that kind of thing. But it's not just that he's being exploited. It's what he's being exploited or how he's being exploited. To me, it just brought back memories of, what's his name? Little Chinese dude. How she had him like acrobatic all the time. I mean,
she makes some caricatures.
Caricatures, yes, she completely. And so, well, I think she's softer and less, not harsh, but less so with Henri Christian as she was with Mr. Willoughby. Oy, it's still got a touch. So, I was like, oh, okay. She pulls him out for the entertainment value. But not for her, but not for her entertainment benefit, but so she can have people be out of the way and not block her son. So, I mean, I it's a good end, but So she gets down to business.
Though I guess it's just like a job, like anyone else has a job.
But I mean, I guess you got to do what you got to do, and you got to exploit your family or employ your family in whatever way you got to. So she gets down to business and is able to remove the teeth she wanted, the abscessed one, as well as the baby teeth over the canines. And she even has Ian pay the mom a little bit for her upcoming dowry later on. But as she's trying to finish her work, something crosses her path of light outside. And she sees that it's a well-dressed man looking down at Henri Christian. And then the girl she's working on passes out and she stops breathing. So Claire gets her on the floor. She does her magical CPR and brings her back. Or she starts breathing again. And the mom is like, what
does CPR look like to people? Back then, does it just, why are you punishing them?
Well, the girl is, and so the girl, when she starts breathing again, because she's still passed out, of course, because of whiskey, she's moved to one of the hellions or the wildcats, whatever she's called, beds to sleep off her whiskey. Then Claire begins to chat with the dude from outside. He says, no, I'm not here to have a tooth pulled. This man was indeed a dandy, beauty patches and everything. He asks if she's Mrs. Fraser. She goes, yeah, but which one were you looking for? And he goes, oh, the one connected to James. And he wants to talk to Jamie. And she says, the captain of his ship reported that a James Fraser had spoken to him regarding seeking passage. And this dandy's name is Percival Beauchamp. So Claire's, of course, distracted about the same last name thing, while the Percival dude is asking about Marsley. So she begins to compare herself to him, meaning the dude. She's like, yeah, he has pale skin too, and da-da-da-da-da. And then he asks about Henri Christian, and alarms are finally beginning to go off. So she's been distracted thinking about a possible family connection, and now he's asking after one too many people, and she's like, oh, what, heh? And he's asking if does Henri have a French connection? And she's like, no. And he says he is looking for a man named Claudel, born in Paris. And he plops out, basically tells her the story of Fergus's early life. And he says that he'd spoken to Jamie's nephew, Michael, already. So this is Ian's brother, an older brother, young Ian's older brother, who went to basically take over the wine trade from Jared. Right? Yeah. It's been years, actually. So he already knew. This information has already been given to him. He's like not making it up out of his butt. He's not pulling it out of his butt. She's just gonna either confirm or deny it, but the guy knows that it's come from somewhere. It came from somewhere else, not from him. And she tells him, well, you know, you need to talk to Jamie about that. And he's gone till tomorrow, but I'll let him know you came by. So later, when Jamie does come back, she fills him in. And he says he'll speak with Fergus first. And then, they're about to end this chat, someone comes to the door. It's a Mrs. Abigail Bell. Now, she has heard. So, man, this is the second person who has heard that Jamie's asking about a ship for Scotland.
He's not memorable.
Oh, there's that. Oh, Lord. There's the look.
It's not like,
but this, I mean, this person hasn't even mentioned the look yet. She's just, maybe if he were more nondescript, word would not have gotten around. Because it's not that word can't get around, but the fact that this very nondescript, or whatever, not nondescript, this very standing out-ish person, superhuman giant tall for those times, bright or reddish hair, male, blah, 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 was asking about it. So it's not that he asked about it that I think, yeah, probably got the attention. It was him who got people's attention. And of course, they were interested in who he was, what he was doing. And that's why I think it's an extra reason why it's gotten around, the fact that someone, and his name is Jamie Fraser, had been asking about booking a trip, a ship to Scotland. And this Mrs. Bell said that she'd like Mr. Fraser to look for her husband when he gets to Scotland. It was a Mr. Richard Bell. He had been a merchant in Wilmington, but was accused of being, he was a loyalist. He was accused of being a loyalist and then abducted and put on a ship bound for England. So that's one task that this will be picked up later on. But that's one thread of their later, or if they make it, we don't know yet. If they go to Scotland, outside of what their entire, they have their own reasons for going, right? Jamie wants to get his printing press as well. But now he's got another thing to potentially look into doing, look for someone. Jamie and Claire recount how they'd met Phaedra. And, or am I thinking, oh, sorry, I'm wrong. Not they. Mrs. Bell, the Bells, they recount how they'd met Phaedra in a tavern there and learned from Neil Forbes of the Fraser's death by fire. They tell him they can get him to a ship. They're like, we know about a possibility. And then they say that a kinsman of their father is Andrew Bell. He's another printer and he happens to also be in Edinburgh. And of course, Jamie knows. Of course, Jamie knows everybody. Jamie knows. He's like, oh, we Andrew Bell. Yes, Jamie knows him. He's the same one who is holding Jamie's own printing press. So that's a coincidence, right? Or a, what do we call it?
It's a grange, but it's also convenient.
Oh, well, like super most granges convenient. Are convenient. Let's be honest.
They are. But this one is a grange that doesn't actually include grange.
Oh, oh, that. That's
did
funny.
I just say it again? I tried to say John Gray. I don't know what I said.
You did say grange.
It could have been grange.
but the thing was, I didn't notice, and I totally knew what you meant. So the next scene, they camp out and ogle Beauchamp. Meaning they like they look for Jamie in Vegas. Did you hear what I just said?
I something about Vegas.
No,
what did you Jamie, say?
I said Jamie in Vegas.
I didn't hear the F. I just heard the Agus part.
I just heard it. And I was like, wait, that's no. They're not supposed to have the same vowel sound. Jamie and Fergus are not really camping out, but they're like, I think they're in a tavern. I could be wrong. They're somewhere looking through glass, but they're spying-ish on this man, Dandy Beauchamp. Now Fergus says he doesn't recognize him. Beauchamp is walking down the street and he stops to chat with Germain, who happens to be out there. Germain then comes in after they chat. Germain comes in to sit with Jamie and Fergus, and he joins him in the tavern, and he says that he's met the man who wants Fergus, who's looking for Fergus. Germain says, that's not a Frenchman. And they're like, huh? And he's like, well, when I threw the toad on him and it, you know, freaked him out and he was dancing back and forth trying to get the toad off, he cursed in English when the frog landed on his shoe. And that's a pretty, like, brilliant little thing for a child to logic out. Because anyone can curse in any language. But if you are surprised or scared, typically it's going to be your, for lack of a better reference or lack of a better term, it's going to be your original programming that comes out.
I don't know, man. I got real good at German cursing.
Yeah, but I think, but if something really scared you or startled you, I still, it's all, it's 99.9% going to be English. For me, he also finds out that the ship Beauchamp was sailing on was owned by a man named Baron Amandine. Now, this is like dang, Germain. I didn't even know if they had to. Germain had to know something to ask these questions. How would he have known about asking about a ship? Unless he knew there was a ship involved. Like, he had to know something. The plan is for him to leave the next day. A man that Germain had been sent to find. So, yeah, okay. She confirms it here. He had been involved. He was involved and he had been given an assignment. This dude's name was Delancey Hall. He was sitting there with them in the tavern. And he tells them they're seeking passage to Edinburgh. Jamie and them tells them, okay, Germain had been sent out to find a man, Delancey Hall. And that was whom Jamie and Fergus were sitting with in the tavern. And he's telling Mr. Hall that he is seeking passage to Edinburgh. And he passes over some of the gold. And they agree they'll make plans. Later on, Jamie is thinking that he knows the name Amandine, but he can't put a face with it. he believes he'd heard the name at court. Fergus says he doesn't want to speak to Beauchamp. And Jamie says, you never know. It could be a good idea to find out his purpose, the reason he wants to speak with you at the very least.
And that was chapter 18. Moving right along to chapter 19, I Fond Kiss.
Wilmington, Colony of North Carolina, April 18th, 1777. The Wilmington Gazette headquarters had been easy to find, or at least what was left of it. It had also, as the Frasers, suffered a fire. Two nights before Jamie and Claire had gone there, it had been burned down. Amos was the owner of the Gazette, but he was gone. He'd been a member of the Sons of Liberty. So Jamie chats with the landowner, a man named Herbert Longfield. He asks where he could find Amos regarding a piece of news that had been published in the Gazette recently. He says the news he was going to inquire about was a house fire. And Amos's business partner, George Humphreys, so no one knows about Amos, but the landowner, Herbert Longfield, says, his partner, George Humphreys, is still around. Come with. And that's a sign for Claire to F off. So Claire Fs off and goes for a walk along the harbor. She sits to eat her lunch and ponders quite a lot of things, including mentioning Mr. Beauchamp in her next letter to Bree. She wonders if they ought to be doing things to ensure their inclusion in some historical archive someday, meaning her and Jamie. While she's in her daydreams, a man says to her, I beg your pardon, madam. And it's Tom effing Christie.
Good Lord. But she took us such a long time to tell us that.
Oh, yeah.
Because, she just kept talking. I couldn't believe it was this person. And then he kissed me. I was like, who is this?
Surprised, she takes a step back and almost falls into the harbor. If not for Tom grabbing her against him. He pushes her away when he's like, oh, yeah, but you can't put your breast up against me, even though you pulled her. And he pushes her again, and then he pulls her right back and kisses her passionately. And then he says, you're dead. and she thought the same. And they agree they need to chat, but nope, not in public, so they go into a pub. Why had he even...
But aren't pubs public, too? That's why they're called public houses. Oh, it's a lot
public, yes, but... Yes, but you can find it's like a restaurant, right? You can find a quiet corner and just be with yourself. You don't have to make a scene outside. Anyone and everyone, it's free to walk around outside. Typically, you're not going to go into a pub or a restaurant or somewhere and sit down and take up space without buying something. So it's not typically free to go into a pub. Anyone's welcome, but you have to have money. So blah, blah, blah. Why had he even gotten her attention? Well, he'd seen that she was reading, or at least she had with her, one of his tracts. Some man named, and that's what got his attention. But he tells her some man named McCreary had told Tom that the Frasers had all died in a fire. And so Tom had placed the notice of the fire. And she asks about his hand. His hand is still doing well. And with regard to the last time they had seen each other, once Claire had left that boat, the cruiser, Governor Martin had realized he didn't have a scribe. I'm thinking in German, a scribe or a forger. So Tom, who had just confessed to the murder of his daughter, Summer, who had just confessed to the murder of his daughter, he's like, I read and write. So later, he actually had admitted to the governor that his confession had been false, but that he was certain of Claire's innocence. Tom was thereafter put ashore, and he looked around, and he'd begun speaking with a local reverend and began seeing students, and so I'm guessing tutoring, and preaching on a Sunday. She tells him they're looking for a ship to go to Scotland. And when he hears this, he spews his drink all over and then tells her he's glad he's had a chance to see her again.
That was a short-lived statement, though. He's like, I'm glad I got to see you again, but I will never have peace while you're alive.
That's true. So they split up and she goes on about her errand. She goes about her errands, getting a pair of scissors made and then inquiring after having some needles for Jamie made. And then when she meets up with Jamie, he knows everything already. Somehow, somewhere, he'd already met up with Tom, who'd confessed everything, even their kiss. Jamie's like, okay, just tell me, Sazenov. It's all good.
Is this the one where he ends the whole chapter by saying, I like ham?
Huh?
There's a chapter when he and Claire are angry messing around with each other. And they were slapping and kissing and talking about that kind of stuff. And then I swear the whole chapter ended with, I like ham. And it made me laugh because that was a weird way for Davina to end the chapter. Her voice just going, I like ham.
I don't remember that. I didn't listen to it. I read it, but I don't remember that.
Moving right along to chapter 20 entitled, I Regret. And I'm so glad it's not in French because they like to put these words in French to make them sound fancier.
Long Island, New York, September 1776. So we are, yet again, back with Will I Am a year earlier. He's gotten into some trouble and he was sent to Long Island. As he's out at one of his assignments, he runs into Captain Richardson. And Captain Richardson offers to have a word with Pickering to mend things because William's gotten into some trouble with Captain Pickering. But what does William have to do in return? Richardson tells him there's a man named Captain Randall Isaacs going to Canada on military business. The person he's meeting has little English, and Randall Isaacs has no French. So
can you imagine William, there was a time when that was a common thing to say?
Has no French?
No, that he's going up to do combat in Canada or meet up with military in Canada. Like, the Canada we live next to today, I don't associate with war.
Because our border is pretty peaceful. Well, our relationship with them is pretty peaceful. And Randall Isaacs has no French, so William might be able to be helpful. And so William, he says he'll think about it, but in his mind, he's already thinking yes, but he says that he will let him know. So as William is also keeping an eye out for smugglers, he's invited aboard a ship to go look for some. And it's actually not just smugglers, it's also traitors, basically. Spies, traitors. Spies are traitors in this context. So they reclothe him because he can't go out in that outfit. In his outfit, they reclothe him in clothing more fitting to chasing after spies. So basically not sticking out. He has to go barefoot, though, because they have no shoes that will fit him. They're on the lookout for a General Hale. And so they get to a spot. Or they're walking around now, and the person he's with is named Rogers. As they're walking along, Rogers, his host, says that he took Captain Richardson over from New York and back. He tells William that he might think twice about saying yes to whatever Richardson's suggested to him. Now, as soon as I read that, I thought, this little jaunt they're on right now, I mean, sure, he invited him, and yes, William could have said no, but William really didn't have a reason to say no. William wanted to get out of Dodge, basically. He wanted to, you know, he wanted a little adventure or, you know, not be cooped up in the same place he'd been. However, so I do think William, I don't think William thought much about what was happening. He just thought as an opportunity to get out and maybe have some adventure. Who knows? But I do think that Rogers, especially after having learned about Richardson having offered him something, thought it could be entertaining, you know, a diversion to get away from where he was, but also teach him a very important lesson about what happens to spies. And thus try to perhaps influence him or at least get him to think really seriously about saying yes to Richardson. So they're on the tail of, or trying to find, they're tailing General Hale. They went to a tavern to eat, and of course, Hale's there. He's the spy they're looking for. And Rogers and other newcomers, so there's like I don't know how many, I did not count, but there was a good little chunk of them. They disparately, you know, in their own order, in their own time, made their way to the tavern and then to around Hale's table and were listening. And they were very convincing, and Hale eventually makes his rebel sympathies known to all. So that tells us that Hale is British, or likely English, and a soldier. And he's now telling everyone who will listen that he has sympathy for the rebels or the American cause. There's a skunk incident, and Hale leaves around the same time, and they go looking for him. They finally find him. And was it Hale? I wrote Hale, and then later I wrote Howe. So now
it's Hale.
That's what I thought. Okay. So they eventually find him where he was staying. He had a room, I guess, at this inn. And they took him, and they hanged him. And
after a very long, offering.
I know. It was, So they hanged him. They gave him time. It's like, okay, this is going to happen. He wasn't surprised. He knew how things worked. He was a general in the British military. Come on. So he knew, he was not surprised that they came for him. He knew this was a possibility, I should say. And they gave him time to write his last letters and communicate his home and all of that. And then when they did hang him, the worst part was not everything we've talked about so far. The worst part was that it was new rope, and it took him an hour to die.
And he didn't want a mask.
Huh?
Or a hood.
Oh,
he didn't put a hood on.
Yeah, but that was his choice. That's not their fault.
It was his choice, but it was...
It's their fault that they didn't have an older rope.
Yeah.
But they could have, honestly, at that point, if it doesn't happen in a minute or five, you freaking shoot me in the head. I don't care. That is not okay. I guess their hands were tied, but whatever.
That was chapter 20. Moving along to chapter 21, entitled The Minister's Cat.
Back in Scotland, Lallybroch, October 1980.
Ooh, I can't wait to see this.
Oh, I know. Roger, the last time we'd heard of him, he had left. I just keep saying this term, and it makes me laugh, so I'm going to keep saying it. Roger had effed off to Oxford, and now he's due back this today, whatever this day is in October. They don't know what time, but he's due back that day. Brianna hears only silence. She's okay. We don't. I think she's in the kitchen. I could be wrong. She's somewhere at home in Lallybroch, and she realizes she's not hearing the kids. There's no, like, there's nothing of them talking or fighting or no little happy kid noises of playing and entertaining themselves.
So she's
immediately suspicious, because this is not the norm. Diana, through Brianna, tells us about something that had happened recently. One of the kids, it had to be Jem. So there was an alarm clock had been taken apart and, like, maybe not destroyed, but taken apart and left, like, in a bathtub, I think.
In a basket.
And so she had asked them, she or Roger had said, what happened? The kids blamed it on the piskies. And the funny thing was, actually, it was Jem blamed on the piskies and said, I didn't do it. It was the piskies. And then Mandy says, the pishkies, or whatever she says. And then he says, and Mandy's too young or too little. And she's like, yeah, I'm too little. So it was straight up not ever going to be Mandy. She was too small to do that. But it was
I just want to know where it was. Where did it break? Was it broken because it was taken apart?
No, I think they took it apart. I think they took
it apart. Or was it broken because they were reaching for something and knocked it off of a shelf?
Oh, I didn't think about that. I thought they took it apart. But it makes more sense to hide something if you break it, doesn't it? Because that would make sense. Or maybe it fell and stopped working and they started taking it apart and, like, it couldn't – thought maybe he could fix it somehow. So who knows? It was probably one of those scenarios. So she remembers a chat with Roger about Scottish folklore. And it was through Roger that she had learned about the Nucklevy. It's from Orkney, and it's nasty. She finds in the kitchen that a packet of chocolate biscuits was missing, as was a bottle of lemon squash. She found the kids on the ground, outside on the ground. They had walked a little bit away, and they were looking at some ants, and they were playing physics. Jem's about seeing them ants and how they rolled in a ball and to save each other, blah, blah, blah. You can read it. It's cute. Jem says that Mandy had wanted to talk to Granda, and that's why they came out. They came out there and went up there. So kind of near, I think, near the headstones. Not as far as the graveyard, but outside, definitely. She doesn't know, none of them know, if Jamie was actually buried there. Reader, we're in book 9, and we still don't know. Or in the colonies. We don't know where he ends up. She finds herself walking up to the old Brock, and she's in the burial grounds. She spends some time with her family's headstones, and she finds one that's old, but not as weathered. And it only has two words on it. So it's two words, which she believes are the name. And it's not one line with two words. It's two lines, each with one word. So it's two lines, two words total. And using her fingers to feel it, she can tell that the first line had an E in it.
It started with a Y.
No. And the second line had a Y in it. And maybe a K as well. We're not told what the first letter is. She just knows that she believes it's an E in the first line and a Y in the second line. And maybe also a K in the second line. But every time I read that, I do a quick little run through in my head of characters we know of. I'm like, does anybody we know of? Well, I saw the wide eyes, like, if you've read, I'm not gonna say anything. If you've read book 9, we do know a person whose name has a Y in it, but it's not in the, it wouldn't be in the second line, it would be in the first line. So I don't think it's that person.
She said, what sort of Highland name begins with a Y?
Oh, yeah, I didn't say it didn't start with a Y. I'm saying when she's describing what she feels, it's a Y in the second, whether it's the first, or the last, or the middle, it's still a Y in the second line. She can't think of what, yeah, and that's what, yeah, I wrote the same thing. She can't think of what name would start with a Y. So have you ever thought about that some? I mean, I'm sure we think about it every time we go through that. We're like, oh, but it's not a quick thing, and then we're on to the next chapter. Have you ever spent time thinking about it?
It's like a Y and a K, so trying to imagine.
Well, even if you take the K out, I'm stuck on that Y as a first letter. Now, remember.
Do they have like Young?
The
surname of Young?
I don't think so. I don't think it's Scottish. Doesn't mean someone can be buried up there. But I still, even if it feels like Y is like toward the left and would be the first letter, it's still possible because other letters are weathered as well. It's still possible Y may not be the first letter. You know what I mean? But that may be the first thing she feels. Or the first mark or indentation or whatever. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know of any, definitely don't know of any Scottish or what is considered Scottish last name. That starts with a Y. So Jem says that he's been leaving a stone on a boulder each time he visits. And so Bree goes to do the same. She makes sure, I just read what I wrote and I was like, what? No. She asks Jem. She wants to make sure that Jem isn't seeing Jamie because he talks about, you know, hearing from him or communicating with him or learning from him, whatever.
Well, he talks about him in the present tense.
Yes. And he goes, and she says, you can't see him, can you? And she's like, he's like, no, Mom.
No, he's dead.
He's dead. But he thinks Mandy can, actually. He says, Jamie had said that he'd look after them. And indeed he did. So as they go back to the house, she asks Jem if he knows what a nuclevy is. He says yes, that he'd told them about it. The nuclevy. The nuclevy had told them, Jem and I'm guessing Mandy, what a nuclevy was. Okay, that will be unpacked at some point.
No, he didn't tell them what it was, but he knew what it was, and he didn't want to see him become one is what I took from that scene.
He learns about the details of one from, I think, the books that they have.
Right. So he's already familiar with it.
Not before the guy says it. She asked Jem if he knows what a nuclevy is. He said yes, that he'd told them about it. That's how he knows. And then we get a description of the nuclevy. And the description, I believe, is what he got from their books. But, or it's possible that they had, you know, as you said, read the books or seen pictures at the very least and then put it together, which would have made the man even scarier. I did find, they're not pretty. So the Declavi is a, according to Wikipedia, I'll include the link in the show notes, is a horse-like demon from Orcadian, so from Orkney, Orcadian folklore that combines equine and human elements. British folklorist Catherine Briggs called it the nastiest of all the demons of Scotland's Northern Isles. The Nuklevi's breath was thought to wilt crops and sicken livestock, and the creature was held responsible for droughts and epidemics on land, despite being predominantly a sea dweller. So, I mean, yeah.
Did we skip over the skunk?
Huh?
Did we skip over the skunk in the last chapter?
No, I said there was a skunk.
Okay.
In there.
It was the most descriptive scene of skunk spraying that I ever called in current day.
Go ahead. Little dancing of the feet.
Well, it's like, how many times are we going to bring it up? We brought it up with Ian a lot.
Oh, that, yeah.
And now it's coming up again. And I'm like, it's like everyone has to have their first experience of the most disgusting smelling animal that exists in California. Or not California, the Americas.
Yeah, it's definitely, I am happy never to run into one in the wild. I hope not. So Jem says that they, meaning him and Mandy, they'd met a man, or at least it was in man form. They didn't actually meet the monster, but the man had said he was the monster. And Bree asks him, what did he look like? And she said, oh, he was big, about the size of Roger. Jem said he hadn't told his parents because the man said he'd come back and eat Mandy if he did. And so she thinks it was most likely a tramp. So someone, those of you who are maybe Gen X, not Gen X, excuse me, younger like than hobo. Gen X, or at least at the very least, millennial or younger, or I should say, millennial might know, elder millennials definitely should know, but like Gen Z may not have really heard of that word. At least it's not used much these days. But tramp is what they used to call tramp and hobos, or what they used to call homeless people. Although I know it has more connotations, but at least when we were growing up in the 70s and 80s, that's what it was much. I heard the word tramp or hobo a lot more than we ever hear it now. I'll say that much. So he wasn't afraid that the monster man might be up at the Brock at all. He wasn't afraid that he was around, because after the guy had done, had, you know, threatened them, like, if you tell anybody, I'm going to come back and eat your sister. After the guy had done that, Jem had stuck around and, like, kind of, I guess, hidden. We're meant to believe he hid or something, but he stuck around to watch him leave. And he said that the man went away in the West, which was funny. We learned from Bree, because that's where most of the dangerous things ended up going off to in a folklore anyway, or coming from, but definitely going off to. So it's nearly sunset when she finally hears Roger's car. After she fills Roger in on all the happenings and monsters, he goes out to have a look for himself. He confirms that indeed someone had been out in the Brock. There were fresh drag marks on the Brock floor where the door had been forced open, pushed open, pulled open. And she tells him and us that she got the job she'd applied for. And he wants to tell her about what he found in Oxford before they have dinner. So they go out for a walk. So his news is he has a job if he wants it. He can be assistant choir master. But he'd gone to Oxford to see about being a minister. Not for a job in Oxford, but to find out some information. He'd come close, as readers will, show watchers only, you will not know this because they did not follow this in the show. But if you've read book 6, Breath of Snow and Ashes, you will know this. He'd come very close, like literally within a hair's breadth of being ordained. The night before
Brianna got kidnapped and ruined everything.
The night before he was supposed to be ordained, Jamie shows up and says, it's Brianna, you'll come. And he went.
Exactly.
And they saved Brianna from the pirate. So he had to think about a lot of stuff. He shows her a document that he'd copied while he was there. Because he went there to do a few things. But he'd copied an article from the Wilmington Gazette. And the date was different.
than the one that they'd seen that ultimately sent them, or sent Brianna first, back to the 18th century, about probably, what, 6 or 7 years earlier.
But see, now I want to know what they did that changed it. Like, what was the move that they did in the past that made this change? Because it still occurred. It just didn't happen on the same date.
When the date was coming up, they all left the house and all went and stayed in the Higgins cabin.
Mm-hmm.
They even had, like, Adso in a cage, like, in a little thing. Like, he was not happy. Because that was the day that they saw. So I think it's not that they changed. So by doing that, because again, at that point, no one was planning on going back to the future. At that point, they were just trying to, like, not die or escape the fire.
Right.
And in the end, what happened there? There was no fire. Well, I think now what we don't know, because it's not stated, is the cause of the fire of the original date. It may have just been an oopsie house fire, and they were able to escape it because they knew of the date. Yet, as if you, not you, Summer, but maybe you're, I hope you read it one day, but if anyone has read, probably any fiction that involves time travel, because I haven't read all of it, obviously, but I have recently finished at least the books that are out and available, The Chronicle of St. Mary's by Jodi Taylor. And one thing you learn reading pretty much any time travel series is that if you know about something that's already happened, right, and your intent is to change it, or even, you know, go back to a time and try not to, don't want to affect a timeline, that, you know, little things that may be out of your control, your mere presence can set off things that change it, even though you didn't physically, like, you know, go kill someone.
So is this like the Final Destination answer, where it's like,
I think
death
so.
Will not be denied.
Yes.
You cannot escape your fate.
I believe. Well, they escaped their
it
fate.
Will find a, they did, but the thing that happened
Correct.
Still happened.
An incident still happened. So from what we understand, there was, when before Bree and Roger went back, right, there was a fire on a date, or at least reported on a certain date. And it was also reported that they died. Okay. So that, of course, sends everybody back. That ends up being the reason for the creation of Jem and later Mandy. So everybody goes back, or the two of them go back, create two babies. But I think it was before, I could be wrong about Brianna. I think it happened after they left. I'd have to go back and look at the books to see what the order was, but I think I could be wrong. Either way, it doesn't really matter. The day the original fire was supposed to occur, however it started, and whoever was killed or not killed on that day, whoever was present, whether it was before or after before or after Bree and Roger had left or not, those people in the big house went and stayed in the Higgins cabin. So that either shows that, well, okay, number one, they did that, and as a result of it, so then I guess you could say potentially that, okay, they were not in the place where it was supposed to happen, and thus, since it didn't happen, if they had stayed and it had happened, it was on an oopsie by someone who was there. Like, that's one potential, right? But yes, to answer your question, I think so, yes. History with a capital H does not change. And if history does change, it's with a small letter H, meaning a fire still occurred and people were reported dead, and people actually died, right? But people were, certain people, the Frasers, were reported dead in a certain newspaper. All of that still happened. And the same outcome, or at least reported outcome, that the Frasers died, right? So really nothing changed newspaper-wise except for the date. But what we don't know is if the original fire was the same fire due to, what's his name? The D guy? It starts at the D. He's a TT.
He sure is. Let me think of his name.
I want to say not Duolingo. Not Dante. The whistling dude. Donner. Yeah, Donner. So what we don't know is if the original fire involved Donner. Without going too far back, why did it...
To be fair, they didn't mention Donner in this one either.
Huh?
I said to be fair, though.
That part doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the cause was. I'm saying the result was a fire of the big house, and because their normal inhabitants were the Frasers, they were assumed dead. Frasers were assumed dead, and that is what was reported, right? Mm-hmm. So, and they didn't have forensics back then; they couldn't identify bones and blah blah blah. So, of course, they're going to report that. So that part makes sense. That the only difference is a date. What we don't know, though, is if the original fire, and this I'm trying to logic this out in real time, we don't know if the original fire was caused by similar incidents of the new fire, or the fire that actually ended up taking place on the new date. And the reason I think we can logic this out is if Brianna had not gone back, would Donner still be there? The answer is yes. Correct?
Right.
Him going back had to do with the 60s. Like that was, it was not related to Claire at all. If Brianna had not gone back, would Donner still be trying to eventually get back home? I think yes. So her being there had nothing to do, or I should probably say opposite. Donner's MO, not his MO, Donner's entire reason, or his entire arc, I guess, his entire reason for being there, or his character's entire, like, what I want to do and why I want to do it, has nothing to do with Brianna. Now, he does meet her at River Run, remember? He's arrested and then thrown out. So he does meet her. But again, I don't even think that matters so much. But I guess the way you tie it into Claire is he went to the big house because he heard, maybe at River Run, I don't know, but he heard somehow. Well, he learned from Claire that it had to do with gems, I think. He already knew about gems because he went through from his Raymond dude. But he learned from Claire when he was part of the gang that kidnapped her and raped her. He learned from Claire at that point that you could go back. It was possible. And he learned from her, I think, that she had gone through a few times, I think. So that itself, and even if, forget it, even if she didn't tell him anything, she did, because of the music, she did, well, he recognized her first because of how not afraid she was, right? Compared to other women. So he came to her and she basically confirmed it to him because she recognized the song and all of that. Excuse me. But in their chat, even if she never said, I've traveled back and forth four times or three times, which I'm not convinced, I don't have the book in front of me. I'm not saying she did or didn't, but just by confirming she was a time traveler puts a bullseye on her head, right? For Donner, because if she knows how it works, and that, let alone if she knows how to go back, and he doesn't, I think, so that's why I think she does tell him that, then it puts a target on her and her family, I would say. And I don't know the conversation they had, or I don't know how he exactly found out they had, like, quote unquote gems, plural. I don't know how that occurred, but obviously that was not his fault. Jamie had, it's not a lie, right? They had gems. He didn't have 7,000 of them, but it did get, it's an honest mistake or an honest oopsie that it got around. You can't blame that on Donner. You can absolutely hold Donner responsible for being the nasty ground that he was.
Right. But we should also consider that if this was a book from Donner's point of view.
Yeah.
Claire would kind of be a selfish bitch.
For not sharing?
Not helping.
Oh, yeah. So all this to say, everything I just said, does any of that change if Brianna does not go back? I don't think so. I mean, no. I don't know, because a lot of it. Okay, the circumstances of Donner do not change, right? Because that's not related to Claire and it's not related to Brianna. However, and this, I don't think this is necessarily related to Brianna going back, but he would still have to be part of the Hodgepodge gang. And that, I think, that was all, you know, that was also unrelated to Claire and Brianna. So there's, I think, plenty of evidence to show that the original fire date, or the fire that occurred at the later date that actually happened after the Mackenzies had gone, mm-hmm. that ended up killing Donner, all that, you can make an argument that it was exactly what had happened the first time around, you know, because there was no, because none of that was reliant upon Brianna or Roger going back. So I think the only reason that it was on a later date was because they knew about the original date and they all hold up in the, well, see, that's iffy too. They all hold up in the Higgins cabin. But what if, okay, why didn't Donner come that day over to the big house? So it's more than just one thing. It's more than just Donner's movements, right? So there's definitely more involved. But think about it this way. I guess all this to say, as soon as Brianna made the decision to go back, let alone Roger and everything, as soon as she decided to go back, she was already changing history. And that little change, the whole butterfly thing, that little tiny change could have been enough to set Donner off 3 days or a month. We just don't know. So could her going back have affected it? I'm sure it had ripples everywhere, you know, in certain things. Maybe not like in Timbuktu, but certainly in North Carolina, because that's where she ended up. So we could spend like 5 more hours talking about this. And it is fascinating. But I do think, to answer your question, it is absolutely a matter of history, capital H, cannot be changed. And if it is, it still happens in a slightly different angle or day. But you can't escape history with a big H. Does that make sense?
Yes, but every time you say that, I think you're implying Hitler.
Oh, gosh. Oh, Summer.
With a capital H. History with a capital
okay,
H.
Okay, so we I'm have...
Like, what history happened?
Oh, Lord have mercy. But the thing is, now they have proof that it could be changed. Now, the outcome? Maybe not so much. But a date change is a freaking change. So that is great. I guess, to know. So what made him even consider looking into this had been Claire. So a little bit before they left the ridge, he'd gone on a night wander and found Claire. They'd chatted about what she was doing there, collecting plants. And she tells him she saw the king once, meaning her king of England when she was in her own time, when she was training or serving as a nurse. He'd come once to Pembroke Hospital to visit the soldiers. Claire says that when she and Frank had first met the Reverend, remember that is Roger's adopted father and uncle, actual uncle, he'd said that Roger's father had been shot down over the Channel. But Roger had said he'd been shot down over Germany. So you have conflicting accounts. Okay, stop it. You have conflicting accounts, right? Not really important because he's dead either way. But both he and the Reverend had, so this is a commonality, mentioned that he was a Spitfire pilot. And Claire's like, I don't know what happened to your father, but I don't think what they told you was correct. Whether they made it up on purpose or they were just telling you what they were told. She says Spitfires were small aircraft and made for defense, and they never crossed the channel. They didn't have the range to cross the channel. She goes, mistakes happen.
Yes.
Yeah, mistakes happened, but during the war, Frank had written her pretty frequently until they'd recruited him for MI6. And after that, he wrote pretty rarely. But what he did tell her at one point was that a Spitfire had gone down, it had crashed in Northumbria and had burned, and there was no sign of the pilot. And he mentioned the name of the pilot, Jeremiah. She says, there are circles of standing stones in Northumbria. And that's what we get there.
So here's my question from that, though. Mm-hmm. Did he crash because he zoomed out of the body to a different time? And is that why the plane crashed? Or did the plane crash in a circle of standing stones and he arrived dead at a new location?
You have to read the bumps, The bulges.
The bulges.
Yes. You have to read the bumps. You have to read the bulges. I think this is a night, blah, 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 A Leaf on the Wind of All Hollows. Read that one. It's so good. It's so good.
I own it. I just haven't read it.
It's pretty short too. I mean, it's compared to a big book. So that's what we get. So Mandy begins to wail from a bad dream. They comfort her and she says something naughty outside was trying to get into her window. They settle her and Roger says he's not going to look for where his father may have gone. Okay, that's a separate thing. Number one, he's not going to go look for where his father may have gone. It's at least his intent right now is not to leave his family and go take on this new epic voyage. He says the reason is because it's too important, a father. And she's like, oh, you remembered your dad, even though you were like an infant when he died or very young? And he's like, no, but I remember your father, Jamie. And he's like, I know how important it was to have him and how important of an influence. So I don't want my kids not to have that.
But I also feel like she was kind of a dick to not remember that and tell him sooner.
I not remember what?
But the stuff about his dad.
Oh, Claire.
Like, that was a story. Yeah, Claire should have told him that story.
Claire
like
said she hadn't thought about it
ago.
Until a few weeks before that.
Exactly. She's self-involved.
Oh, I mean...
And lastly, this week we will be discussing chapter 22 entitled Flutterby.
Wilmington, North Carolina Colony, May 3rd, 1777. Jamie has been dreaming of the bairns. He says he saw Jem and Mandy. They were outside playing, sitting in and amongst the gravestones behind Lallybroch. They'd gone to the Brock and he'd had an unsettling feeling about it. He didn't want them to go in, and he felt as though something was inside waiting.
Something was. That's it?
That's it. What else am I going to talk about? That's all that happened.
I know, but I just thought there was a lot more words used in 8 pages.
Girl, I told you, I tried to shrink it down.
I get it. All right. And that was chapter 22 and the end of part 2.
Woo-hoo!
So join us next time, and we will continue An Echo in the Bone read-along, and start part 3, entitled Privateer, with chapters 23, Correspondence from the Front, 24, Joyeux Noël, I think it's Christmas, y'all, and 25, The Bosom of the Deep. And rounding that reading off with 26, entitled Stag at Bay.
Again, a special thanks to co-producer Elizabeth S., to find out more about how you can support us on Patreon, visit outlanderpod.com/Patreon.
And if you're looking for people to hang out with and talk Outlander when there's not Outlander going on, please feel free to join us on our group at www.outlanderpod.com/group. And should you be wanting some Outlander Pod merch, you can head over to our shop at outlanderpod.com/shop.
If you haven't subscribed to our newsletter yet, the Outlander Pod Gazette, please do. You can find us at outlanderpod.com/newsletter. And thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.